You're listening to the Kinky Coach Podcast with Stephanie
and Fox.
Hey, Fox.
Yeah?
You've been a bad, bad boy.
Nice boy.
This show contains explicit content
and is intended for mature audiences only.
This is what happens when an innocent, successful mental health professional
falls for a rugged, prior-deployed bad boy.
You get one hell of a ride.
I see you're playing a game there.
No, I'm turning it off.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Why you gotta call me out?
Because I get in trouble.
That's just rude.
I get in trouble when I look at my phone.
That's because you can't do more than two things at once.
You can't either.
I absolutely can.
Yes. Well, so tonight, I'm excited. I'm always excited.
I was going to say, you're very excited.
I'm a very excited
you're
person.
You're an excitable person, but not easily excitable. Yeah.
Okay, that didn't make a sense.
Yes, you're an excitable person, but not easily excitable.
Okay, I got you.
It made sense to me.
It made sense to you. Perfect.
It's my logic.
I have with us today the executive director of the STI project, and it's Miss Janelle. And so we're going to talk to her about all things STIs tonight.
STI, STDs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For those older folk, Ken, that don't want to come into the new times, because there are people that will argue with you that an STI is not an STD and vice versa, and also in the medical field. But basically, you contract something when you are being sexual or possibly non-sexual.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's what it falls down to.
So, Janelle, are you with us?
I am.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, tell us all about who you are and kind of a little bit about your background.
Absolutely. So, my name is Janelle Marie Pierce. My pronouns are she, her, and hers. And I am the, as you said, the executive director of the STI project. I'm a sexual health educator, an STI positive sexual health educator, and which just means is a fancy way of saying that I have an STI of genital herpes. And I'm the spokesperson for Positive Singles, which is a website, a dating website, a platform for people who have STIs that caters to the STI community. And then I hold a couple of other titles and roles. I'm a freelance writer, and I do a lot of speaking engagements and have been published in a myriad of different outlets. But essentially, the primary goal and the primary purpose of my work is to normalize the conversation around STIs, to reclaim the STI narrative, and to help anyone who has an STI or would like information about STIs, risk, transmission, everything that really encompasses what that means and the experience of living with an STI, so on and so forth. So yes, STIs or STDs all day, every day.
I love it. So you have the STI project, and tell us a little bit more about that.
All right. So yes, the STI project is primarily an online space. We're a website, the STIproject.com, and then I'm on all social media channels, quite literally all social media channels, even TikTok, and which has been its own little fun frontier of education. And it's a resource that promotes awareness, education, and acceptance in that order. And we offer a platform for people to share their stories and to find some of that more clinical and fact-based baseline information, but then also like the gray area, that storytelling component of what it means to live with an STI, what it means to have conversations around safer sex and sexual health and transmission and disclosure if you have an STI, because so many people do. And actually, to Fox's statement around STI, STD, you'll hear me use them interchangeably. I'm leaning more in the direction of using STI more often, but neither of them are actually wrong in terms of our general colloquialisms. The most current term is STI. It's slightly more medically accurate, and a lot of folks feel as though it's a little less stigmatized. I would actually push back against that assumption, because really all STIs are stigmatized no matter what we call them. A rose by any other name is still a rose, and a piece of poop still smells as stinky and looks as bad. And so, however, what I'm talking about in terms of medical accuracy, and you'll see this in like the sexual health community and education space, as well as in some public health spaces. Some of the authoritative bodies, though, again, are still using them interchangeably, because the vast majority of the general public doesn't know what the term STI is. STI is sexually transmitted infection, and STD is sexually transmitted disease. And all STDs are preceded by an STI, meaning you can have an infection but have no signs or symptoms of disease. So the most common sign or symptom of all STIs is none whatsoever. People are asymptomatic, which is similar to COVID. So we have some parallels right now that we can compare it to that's relevant in our current zeitgeist. But and that means that you can have the infection, you can transmit it to other people, but you don't actually have any noticeable signs or symptoms. So that's an STI. If you do end up having noticeable signs or symptoms, then it's an STD. So like, for instance, I have genital herpes, and I've had it since I was 16. I get active outbreaks, and so I technically have an STD because I have signs or symptoms of the infection, but not everybody always does. So STI is a little more medically accurate. In terms of the stigma, people feel as though infection sounds a little less scary than disease. But when we're talking about something that's sexually transmitted, because of the immense stigma associated with things that you can track through sexual activity, really the stigma exists regardless.
Okay, thank you for that. One of the things that I know, we have lots of clients who come in. Of course, we're a counseling center, so that's what we do. And I just had a client come in who is struggling with, she was just recently diagnosed with HSV2, and she's struggling really hard with that. So kind of walk me through that process of what she can expect from the first, kind of mentally from the first onset of it, because this is within her first month of finding out, and she's pretty devastated.
For sure. Do you mean mentally as in, do you mean mentally as in like what the psychological experience is, or what the physical experience?
The psychological.
Yeah, for sure. So it's really, the vast majority of people have a very similar response, and the initial response kind of mirrors what we see in the grief process. And that's because people are generally grieving their sense of self, their sense of sexual identity and autonomy, their belief around their body and how they saw themselves previously as a sexual being and what that meant to them. And that gets stripped away when someone is diagnosed with an STI. And so what I mean by it mirrors the grief process is, at first there's a lot of shock and disbelief, like, why me, and how did this happen to me, and this doesn't even seem right, and what do I do? And then oftentimes there's a bit of denial of like, no, this can't be right, and anger and frustration. And we have a tendency to want to like finger point, figure out whose fault this is, because we want to assuage the feelings that we're going through, those feelings that feel very negative, even though they're all there for a reason, and there's no such thing as a bad feeling. It's just what we do with these emotions that we have. So initially that shock and disbelief, a little bit of anger and denial. Then sometimes the process becomes, we're really heading toward the idea of acceptance is really what the end goal and what we really hope to achieve out of walking people through this process. And acceptance, I should clarify, not in a way of like being like, yay, I have an infection, woohoo, like who wants to sign up and contract my infection from me? Because no one wants an infection. I didn't want herpes, but I have it. And so now what do I do with it? How do I move forward, kind of thing? And I don't want any additional infections, even though I already have one and I know what that's like. And I've moved forward from those initial first primary stages. I still would prefer to not have any additional maladies or any other health concerns or issues that come up. I just would rather to not, but that's a part of our human experience. So yeah, so there's a lot of different, and they don't always go in that order. So some people walk through it a lot quicker if they find resources, if they have support, if they have a support system. And then some people get stuck in some of those stages for long periods of time, sometimes years, where we isolate and we really feel like we're all by ourselves, and we stigmatize ourselves and feel as though we are less than in subsets of society. And of course, none of that's true, because the vast majority of all sexually active people contract an STI at some point, but most people don't know that.
Yes. So what are the most common STIs?
Ooh, well, one of the most common, the common STIs are going to be HPV. The vast majority of all sexually active people, when I say vast majority, I mean over 80% of all sexually active people contract HPV by the time they're 50, and that's just one of 30 plus sexually transmitted infections and diseases. Then trichomoniasis, or trichomonas, is and also a super, super common infection. That's a bacterial infection. There's three different categories of infections. There's bacterial, parasitic, and viral. HPV, the human papilloma virus, the one I mentioned first, that more than 80% of people contract by the age of 50. That's a viral infection. And yeah, so those are two of the ones that you hear about a little bit more often and that are super common. And depending on where you're at in the world, which demographic you are in, different STIs are more common in some places and for some people than others.
My next question would be about HSV and how common that is to people. You're right, they have to go through the grief process. They feel like their world is ending, but then they have to realize that it's more common than most would ever imagine. Would you agree?
Oh, totally. So it depends on whether we're talking about HSV-1 or HSV-2. Both can be, so HSV is the herpes simplex virus, and there are two different types, type 1 and type 2, HSV-1 and HSV-2. Both can be located orally and or genitally. Historically, HSV-1 was thought of as cold sores and oral herpes only, and then vice versa, HSV-2 was thought of as the genital kind, but now we know they can be located in both locations. They still, each type still has a preferential location, and you see it more commonly in the type that it, or in the location that it prefers. So HSV-1 still is a little bit more common in the United States anyways, orally, and then HSV-2 is a little bit more common genitally. But in the UK, for example, HSV-1 is now becoming more common as a genital infection because of oral sex, because you can get it through oral sex. Like if someone has a cold sore, that's HSV and probably is HSV-1. And then if they are the giver in oral sex, they can transmit it to someone, and then that someone will have then genital herpes, and then their genital herpes will be HSV type 1. So in terms of commonality, that's where it gets a little tricky. Two-thirds of the world's population has an oral herpes infection. Anywhere between 1 in 6 to 1 in 8 is the number that you see popularly published for a genital HSV-2 infection, but that does not include genital HSV-1 infections. And that doesn't include infections that are undiagnosed and undetected. And as with all STIs, the most common symptom is no symptom. You can be an asymptomatic carrier. You can have the infection and be able to transmit it to somebody else without knowing it. And then you wouldn't be a part of those numbers. So the numbers are actually probably much higher. We don't know exactly, because HSV, herpes, both types, is not routinely tested. And so it's not a part of like an STI panel if you get tested for STIs.
Being in the open relationship community, I know that there is, and I guess I saw the stigma that the vanilla world thinks that, well, every swinger, every person in an open relationship is dirty. They have STIs, and I want to remove that stigma.
For sure. I was actually going to say, like, yes, STIs are a concern in an open community, in a non-monogamy, ethical non-monogamy, polyam community, swinging community, whichever category you
sure.
would classify yourself as, whatever type of relationship structures are your preference, but they're an issue in all communities. And it's not actually the assumption that is made, like you said, by vanilla folks, that there are more STIs in these communities is incorrect. And the reason is because oftentimes in these non-monogamous communities, it necessitates a lot more communication that doesn't typically happen in the monogamous community. Mm. Communication about boundaries, about safety, about needs, about expectations. And this is not it's not the case for all dynamics, all relationships, all exchanges of activity, all et cetera. We can't ever say all people in all, we can't ever group all people in any community as doing one specific kind of thing. But we see that more often than not, there's more communication happening. And so there's a little bit more of an exchange, a lot more of an exchange of, okay, have you been tested? Are we going to, what kind of safety precautions do we want to use? Which mitigation methods are going to be what we want to participate in for this specific activity? And then moving forward, there's additional negotiation and conversation. So it is not the case that there's a higher prevalence of STIs in those kinds of communities whatsoever. And it's not necessarily that there is or isn't, it's that it really is the same across the board. But I'm an advocate of the more communication, the better. And that's really what is necessary in order to help people feel safe and to feel good about the decisions they're making with their body. And in a lot of the non-monogamous communities, you see that happening a lot more often. So I actually think that they're more progressive and doing a better job at what really should become normal and a part of our everyday sexual discourse.
I know that there's so many times when people will go to the doctor and they're like, oh, I need a, they'll whisper to their doctor, you know, I need a test, you know, the test. And they won't even verbalize that, heavens forbid they've had sex, but heavens forbid that they have to acknowledge that they need a test for an STI. Embarrassed. Hey, Kinky Nation. Do you need help with navigating the swinging lifestyle? Fox and I offer personalized coaching services designed specifically for your relationship needs.
Are you the person that all your friends turn to when they have questions about sex? You should check out the Kinky Coach Sex Coach Certification Course and get paid for sex coaching instead of doing it for free. Just go to kinkycoach.com.
Lastly, if you feel that you are in need of therapeutic services for your relationship or individually, please visit Beautiful Beginnings with an S. LLC.org for more information on the counseling services I offer. Okay, Kinky Nation, let's get back to the show.
Well, right. And then at that point, that conversation is like, I'm glad that they're asking and advocating for themselves and taking that first step. But that's as far as it goes. And then they don't know which tests they've received, which types of tests. And even if that discussion stops at that point in time, all the areas that could be tested in terms of parts of the body may not be being addressed, depending on what your sexual behavior is, what your partner dynamic and partner's dynamic is. All of that becomes relevant. And it seems awkward. Like when we're talking about testing and you're talking to a practitioner, if you don't just buy testing online for yourself, which is not always financially accessible, it is a lot more expensive to do it that way. Say you go to your regular provider, a general practitioner, or you even go to like a clinic or a specialized clinic that does STI testing, Planned Parenthood, public health department, et cetera, they're going to ask you a lot of what seems like very invasive questions. And they seem invasive because we don't talk about this stuff very often. We're not talking about the activities we're engaging in, the mitigation methods we're utilizing, what our boundaries are, and or at least, again, not in the monogamous community. And so, I even think this is the case for really just all people in general, because most people experience and have and are working through, if they are working through, some level of sexual shame because of our culture, because of the media, because of the education and or lack of education that exists around sexual health and our sexuality and our identities and our bodies, et cetera, et cetera. There are so many things that play into why we feel this. No matter who you are and what your relationship style is, you still have some level of sexual shame, either that you've overcome and you're working on, and or that you are still experiencing. And so thus these conversations feel atypical when really they're meant to try and discern, okay, which kinds of tests are going to be applicable for you, which are the things that we need to look for based on this behavior, and not with a judgment call. Not with it, there's no moralistic approach around this. It's just basically a practicality thing, a biology and science of we need to either swab your throat or your anus, or we need to do a urine test or a blood sample, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you just say, I just want you to test me, and you don't ask for which tests and you don't explain why, or you're not communicating and being forthcoming, which is hard to do when you don't have any practice or any kind of encouragement around that, you don't get very far.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. So speaking from, you know, someone who has a medical license, if you are curious, or if you're worried, or if you're, you know, like Stephanie and I, and you're in a very open relationship, you know, we get checked every 90 days. My doc now knows me well enough that when I walk in and I tell him, hey, I need a full scope, he knows it's a full scope, a full draw, and a full body check. However, those pretty much encompass every possible STI, STD check except for HIV and HPV. You have to very specifically request those. So for those of you out there that are unaware, if you're talking to a general practitioner or anyone in the medical field, tell them you want a full scope, full draw, full body check with HIV and HPV included. And that will give you the full gamut. Now, understand you're going to be there for a while, okay? They're going to test your urine, they're going to test your blood, and they're going to test different orifices within your body, and some of them are going to be uncomfortable. And it's not always going to be fun. But that is the way and the only way that you're fully going to know, you know, what's going on with you.
Even when you do, when you say you want the full scope, it's still important to ask what that practitioner is testing you for, because if you go to the public health department, you're going to be tested for 3 to 5 infections. You're going to be tested for HIV, syphilis, chlamydia, and gonorrhea, almost always those four. And like Fox said, sometimes they won't do HIV, but most health departments will. Some private providers may not too. So you want to ask and make sure that that's included and what type of HIV test is included. It might be a rapid test. You might have to wait to get results. But those are only 4 infections. There are over 30 infections that can and are sexually transmitted. So you can't be tested for all the things, which kind of begs the question of like, what's really the point, and is this really beneficial, and then how do we keep ourselves safe? And that's where it kind of goes all the way back to what I first said, is like, there's no such thing as no community, no sexual behavior, unless it's singular and not partnered, is safe, quote unquote. There are safer ways in which to approach things. And like Fox is talking about, him and Stephanie, they're getting tested regularly. They're getting tested for multiple infections. They're aware of the infections they're being tested for. Those people are typically the ones that are actually the safest, because they know their status, they are proactive, and they're doing things in which to reduce risk. It's the folks who are just like, yeah, I got tested for everything, I don't have anything. Well, if you're sexually active, there's no actual way to know if you have 0 infections. If you've been sexually active with a partner, there's no way to know that. There's a way to know that you're negative for the infections you can be tested for, which is awesome. And I advocate for that, but you can't ever say you're clean, quote unquote. We don't use that language, but we, you know, as soon as somebody does, then they don't have the full scope of information that's accessible to them, or that's the door that would help them in terms of STI education and support. But yeah, it's just, there's a lot of misunderstanding around how safe you can be, or if you are completely safe, or is there some sort of way? And there's just no way. Everything we do has some sort of risk involved, and it's about our own personal risk assessment and how comfortable we are with that risk and what we want to do to help try and reduce it.
No, that's a good point. But to be fair, and not to sell a false narrative about Stephanie and I, we do jump out of planes, so I don't know that the word safe in us is exactly the best thing to use. Sexually safe, yes, but for those that like to jump out of airplanes, I don't know if the safe word is allowed to be used in the same sentence.
Yeah, we have a pretty adventurous lifestyle.
We do, very adventurous.
I love that. I'm a skydiver as well. I shouldn't say I'm a skydiver, like I go all the time, but I've been a few times, and I've done the, each time I did the not the tandem, the why is it eluding me right now, where you jump by yourself.
The static?
You're attached to. Static line, yes, static line. So I didn't get a whole lot of free fall, but I was going with the intent that eventually I might actually get my my certificate and be able to eventually pack my own chute and so on and so forth. And so I never ended up getting to that point, but I wanted to like totally do it by myself and everything. And I tell you what, the scariest part of that is crawling out onto the wing of the plane, jumping and like letting go once you're out on that wing. I mean, there's nothing else for you to do anyways, but yeah. So, and the skydiving is a perfect, amazing example, because when we think about STIs, everyone, the way that culture looks at STIs, the way that stigma has us feel around STIs, some of it is psychologically, it makes sense. And I won't go into all the nuance of that right now, just for this analogy's sake, but, and just in general, because that would be really boring and it would take hours. But in terms of when we look at our risk assessment, everyone takes and assesses their own level of risk and makes risk assessments every single day through everything they're doing. When we leave to go to work, if you're a person who doesn't work from home, not like me, then you make a risk assessment when you get in your car, you put your seatbelt on, you look before you go down the road. There's risk in every decision that we're making, but there's also a reward, and we're taking these risks on purpose for the reward that exists. And the same applies when we're talking about sexual activity and enjoying partnered sexual activity. And hopefully we are enjoying it, and that's the reward, that's the outcome we're looking for, and the intimacy and all the other things and the benefits that come with it. And like skydiving, when we make that kind of decision, there is, Timothy Ferris wrote this in a book, and he changed my perspective around the way in which we look at risk. And he said that when you look at any decision you make ever, you have to apply a reality, you have to take a reality check and look at this risk. And you have to say, is there, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being death, 1 being the very best thing that could possibly happen, like I'll get $1 million, I'll be famous, I'll, whatever the best thing for you could be. And on those levels, what's the likelihood that this is going to happen, that the worst case scenario is going to happen? And so like with skydiving, you do actually have a chance of dying. So that's actually a true legitimate potential risk is the 10. But the likelihood of that happening, you're probably, everything falls, every decision usually falls somewhere in the middle. But not everything even has an outcome of a potential of death. And sexual activity now, with STIs all being either curable, treatable, or manageable, as long as you have access to healthcare, then 10 is not even on the gamut. The worst case probably scenario might be for you like an 8, maybe a 9 at worst, but that's not the likelihood of what's going to happen. The likelihood is going to be somewhere in the middle, and there's also going to be reward involved. And even if you do contract an STI, which is super common, and most people do, they're curable, treatable, or manageable. So we have to look at it from a little bit more of a logical perspective and strip away some of the emotion. The emotion's there and is intentional to help us, but it ends up clouding our judgment or our perception of others. And it also changes our own personal judgment and how we move forward with our own bodies.
Yes, you beautifully said. I can absolutely agree with the correlation between sex and skydiving. That's pretty much.
I personally want to have sex while skydiving.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure I'll lose my license. So, so I just recently became I put on an instructional rating in skydiving as a skydiving coach. So I'm pretty sure that the USPA would smack my hand, pull my rating, and tell me, "No, no, bad boy.
Yeah,
you're not a skydiver anymore."
Yeah, that's true.
They do all sorts of other things skydiving. I don't know why sex is off.
Right.
You know, like they do all the connecting, the tricks that people do and things. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Like, I don't know, what's the difference of joining hands and joining genitals?
You know, so that's a great question. And I think it was about 7 years ago, a tandem instructor who was also I guess he was a mid-level porn star.
He was, yeah.
Yep. He had made some videos, and so he decided to trick his pilot into believing that the drop zone owner told him, "Hey, you can have sex in the plane and jump out with the secretary who happened to be the drop owner's daughter. Yeah. of age, just in case anyone cares. And so he did this. The problem is he did this while they did a tandem jump together because he was a tandem instructor. She was a licensed skydiver. And they put it on film and then they put it on YouTube.
Yep. The problem is they put it on YouTube.
Yeah, it was the problem. So the USPA said, well, that is not the proper way to do a tandem jump. And therefore, they yanked all of his licenses and instructional credits. And now he is, he's pretty much done in skydiving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All for
his ego got the best of him. It ruined a good opportunity and a good story. He didn't have to actually just show it to people. He could have told that story for years to come.
Exactly.
Without necessarily any repercussion, because no one would have approved it. That happens all the time. People get all wrapped up and I want to show somebody this, and then they get themselves in trouble. They ruin it.
Exactly. So speaking of egos, I want you to talk to us, especially to, so the majority of our listeners are, you know, into BDSM, or they're in the swinging lifestyle, or they're polyamorous, or they're bisexual, or. I can keep going on and on. if it has to do with the uncommon sexual practices, that is pretty much our listener base and pretty much what Stephanie and I do.
Personally.
So, talk to us about somebody who is as hypersexual as we are, some safe practices. And I don't mean the normal stuff like, okay, so we all know use a condom. We all know there are certain, you know, types of foam and lube that have certain stringents inside that help you, you know, stay protected for a short time, etc. But what are some other safe practices, right, that are out there that hypersexual people can use that they can feel safe about using and they can feel confident about using as well?
For sure. So I'm trying to decide what I think about your term hypersexual, because I think there's a lot of subjectivity in that, and it almost makes me feel or leans toward folks who say you can have a sex addiction, which there is no such thing. You can be engaged in behavior that is harmful to yourself and or others that is problematic, but really there is nothing that is, yes, the vanilla crowd, or, you know, the idea of like missionary penis and vagina is normal or something. There's no such thing as normal, and there's no such thing as too much, too little. And everyone's version or viewpoint of that is going to be entirely different from one another. So I just want to put that out there of like, I'm not, but I know where you're going, what you're saying. I know what you're leaning toward.
And, no, we agree with you. We use that as practices, a common, just a more of a common language to explain. If that makes sense.
Gotcha. And I, yeah, for sure. And I also believe in utilizing, and people are allowed to use whatever language suits them as it refers to them and as they identify with. So that's thumbs up for that. So in terms of reducing risk, yes, of course, condoms will reduce risk. But I'll even say with the caveat that not all non-monogamous or polyam folks are going to want to utilize condoms with all partners, with all activities, and at all times. And that's a communication and a negotiation that needs to happen. Some folks are going to choose to be fluid bonded while they have other partners that they're not fluid bonded with. And fluid bonded meaning that they're just not engaging with barriers. And so there may be an exchange of fluids during the activities that they're engaging in. So that's a decision that is going to be part of someone's risk assessment. And of course, yes, so condoms are great. They'll reduce risk by a large amount of all infections that are transmitted through fluids, but they're not going to reduce risk by a whole lot. They will by some, but not by a whole lot, for infections that are transmitted through skin-to-skin contact. So that's where some of these other things can potentially be incorporated. Comprehensive safer sex is a combination and a consideration of four different approaches. So barriers is one, that can be internal and external condoms, as well as dams. Condoms can be turned into dams. Saran wrap that's non-permeable and non-microwavable can be turned into dams, etc.
Lube is another class or is another item that's in that category that a lot of people forget about and don't realize reduces risk. Lube, I think, in my personal opinion, in my humble opinion, should be everyone's friend. Usually I don't use a lot of shoulds, never, all, or always when I'm talking about safer sex and sexual health with folks and their bodies and what they could be doing and their considerations. But when I talk about lube, I do think lube should be everyone's friend just because lube is lovely and lube
can make
sex longer. You too. Love it. Love it. So glad. And it's okay if not. And a lot of people just haven't tried it, haven't incorporated it, don't know. There's stigma around lubrication, having a WAP, whether you need to have a WAP. WAP doesn't happen for a myriad of different reasons, and it has nothing to do with arousal. It doesn't always have anything to do with arousal, and there can be all sorts of things that incorporate and cause either not wet-ass pussy or just a need for additional lube and support. And so what I mean, though, in terms of risk reduction, lube itself is a small, very thin barrier. However, where lube helps and really does help with risk reduction is it eliminates, or not, I shouldn't say it eliminates, it reduces the likelihood of small, tiny cuts and tears that happen during regular sexual, any kind of sexual activity, not regular as perceived by the vanilla crowd, but all kinds of sexual activity, tiny cuts and tears happen. Tiny cuts and tears that you wouldn't necessarily feel them or know. It doesn't have to be painful at all. But these just happen because of the type of tissues that are involved in these areas of activity. So the lube would help reduce that. So lube and barriers is one big category. Another big category is testing. So we talked about testing. The golden rule or the way in which to reduce risk and by testing and testing as often as possible is before and after each new partner, which can become tricky if there's multiple partners at one time, but it'd be before and after engaging in activities. But then if you're engaging in new activities with new partners on a regular basis, that's not really practical and or fiscally feasible for all folks or accessible. And so then kind of like Stephanie and Fox are talking about on a regular basis, like every 90 days on a rotation, just because then if you contract something and get tested right away, you may not detect it. So then 90 days later, if you're getting tested on a regular basis, then that will pop up on a test. And typically the majority of things that you can get tested for will show up within 3 to 4 weeks of being exposed to them. Some take a little bit longer, but it just depends on what you're being tested for, and they all have a little bit of different window periods. But anyways, 3 to 4 weeks is a nice way in which to look at it and getting tested regularly. So that's the other category. Then another category is considering lifestyle choices. So that can mean considering limiting and or reducing or eliminating the use of substances during activities. And where this really comes into play, because a lot of people actually actively and intentionally will participate and incorporate substances into their sexual activities. The key, though, is making sure that that's negotiated in advance, that there's very clear, distinct communications and boundaries around what happens if something becomes uncomfortable or feels unsafe when substances are involved. Some people are total advocates for, or are advocates for absolutely no substances whatsoever, but I'm a little bit more flexible around that. And mostly it's no substances while you're negotiating and communicating what your needs are, what your expectations are, what your boundaries are, what ways in which you want to incorporate any risk reduction methods, etc. So that doing that fully clothed, also fully clothed too. So
yeah,
not just the substances, but having that communication while the clothes are still on. And while there has been very minimal, if none would be preferable, like sexual activity in advance before that conversation happens. And that's mostly just from a really true scientific practical perspective, I'm not trying to ruin the fun or the spontaneity of some things that happen, which of course in the non-monogamous community, there's a little less like of this idealized
romanticized media portrayal of that these things just spontaneously happen, and they actually end up feeling better for all parties involved, the physical as well as the psychological, when they're less spontaneous and when there has been communication, boundaries, needs, wants, and et cetera, negotiated. So that said, but it's because of the psychological chemicals that happen when we start getting involved at that sexual level, things fire and our decision-making changes. So we want to make sure that the decisions we're making around our activities are done fully conscientious and in a way that is not coerced by anything else, whether it's substances or whether it's being kind of in the midst and in the heat of the moment, so to speak. So what else am I missing? I think I'm missing another category. Lifestyle choices, barriers, lube, testing, and communication. And we've been talking about that all along. So really, those are your ways in which to reduce risk. You can't ever reduce risk 100%. You can definitely help to feel more safe, more autonomous, more empowered in the decisions that you're making around your body and the risks that you're engaging in, so that if something does happen, you're not shocked. You don't have that first initial response of, oh my gosh, how did this happen to me? And this is the most horrible thing ever, because it's likely not horrible at all. And then now, if you know all of this, if you've made these decisions really thoughtfully and in an empowered, autonomous way, then you move forward. You say, yeah, that kind of sucks, and I still would prefer not to have this STI. Like, I still would prefer not to have genital herpes, but I do. So how do I move forward and have discussions and still enjoy a healthy sex life? And I can tell you that I've enjoyed an amazing sex life and all sorts of amazing sex and partners and things, and herpes has never impacted that whatsoever. Once I stopped allowing it to.
Exactly. I'm glad that you said that. Once you stopped allowing it to rule your life.
Right.
Your sex life.
Right. Both.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, definitely. How do you start that conversation off with potential partners?
So I think the conversation is going to look different for everyone, of course. I think it's also important to do it in an environment that is safest for you. So some people advocate for face-to-face conversations, and depending on the dynamic, the scenario, if you're in a swinging situation, it very well might be face-to-face because that's going to happen at that moment in time, during that party, etc. But a lot of people feel safer or have, it's more authentic for them to do it via technology, like through text message, Snapchat, Messenger, etc. And I'm an advocate for doing it in the way that is most authentic and feels safest for you and your partner or partners, and what's most practical. And especially with COVID, it's not necessarily practical to do always face-to-face communication, and to have that negotiation upfront and to be talking about that in advance. So, and it's nice too, because that gives everyone a little bit of a buffer when and if you feel like that's best for you. If face-to-face is really like your cup of tea and your style, then go for it. Do that. Have that conversation in person. But if you're doing it digitally, it's kind of nice too, because I've had somebody disclose to me digitally, and then and I realized, like, oh, I kind of liked that because it gave me a chance to pause. I didn't have to worry about my facial expression. I could really think what my response was going to be and how I wanted to move forward. It just gave me an opportunity to do a little bit more thought without feeling as though somebody was waiting for that response. Even though I knew they were still waiting for it, they didn't have to watch my process, basically. So, yeah, but do it in a way that's authentic and safe for you. And I think you just tell someone, like, I'm feeling this way, or I think, like, I'm liking this, I'm digging where we're headed, whatever your language is, your colloquialisms, however your vernacular comes out naturally in this conversation. And if it's awkward, say it's awkward, like, this is a little strange, like, I don't know, or I'm not really good at this conversation, but I think it's really important, maybe why you think it's important. And then talk about that. Like, I'm kind of wanting to do this, or feel like we're heading in this direction, but I want to talk about this before we do. What do you think?
and see where it goes from there, and let that person also open up. And that vulnerability that happens is really quite beautiful. Our culture doesn't support vulnerability and doesn't encourage it in a lot of ways. And we're always so worried about calculated risks and knowing exactly what to anticipate, but that vulnerability builds intimacy, even if it's just for a short exchange, even if it's just for a quick physical exchange, or if it's potentially a longer term relationship. That's where that intimacy and that the benefit, the reward really happens. So there's something to be gained from feeling a little bit like, I don't exactly know what to say. Even saying that, I don't exactly know how to say this. That in and of itself helps to, I think, to make the conversation feel more human.
I agree. And educating yourself is another thing that I am passionate about. Make sure that you are educating yourself on the ins and outs of how to manage if it's manageable and how to treat if it's treatable.
Yeah, absolutely. Education is that primary empowerment point, I think, for all people, whether you have an STI or not, is to really understand and to have a sense of what the experience is, how common it is, and what that might mean for you when and if it happens. Because it's very likely, if you're a sexually active individual, that it will happen at some point in time. Not that you have to like it and be excited about it. I'm not excited about going to the dentist in a couple of weeks, and I think I'm going to have a cavity, but I know I need to go, and so I've got to get it figured out. I mean, this is just part of our overall health care and taking care of our sexual health, and everything that comes along with it is part of our wellness, our overall holistic wellness as humans, as living beings on this earth interacting with other living beings. And so it's us being responsible and showcasing like how we want to be treated and how we want to treat others. And all of that, I think, really has this potential for an amazing synergy and beauty if we look at it that way. We just don't typically when we're talking about STIs.
Yeah, STIs tends to be an ugly, dirty topic, but I agree, it doesn't have to be.
Exactly.
So as we're wrapping up, is there anything that we haven't hit upon that you want to make sure that the listeners know?
Yeah, you know what comes to mind? I don't always have an answer for this question. I'm asked this a lot, and sometimes I talk so much that I'm like, oh, I can't even imagine what else I could possibly say before these people fall asleep. But we didn't talk about rejection, and I think that that's really relevant. It's relevant in all communities. It's relevant in non-monogamous. If we're talking about communities, we need to have this conversation regularly. And I want to see this. I want to see this outside non-monogamous communities. I want to see this everywhere where we're having this discussion in a more comfortable, and like it's part of talking about the weather or what do you want to eat for dinner. I mean, all of these things are choices that we make, and I'd love to see this happening more often. But especially in a community in which you're engaging with more partners or partners more often, different partners more often, and there's going to be someone's risk assessment, someone who makes a risk assessment that doesn't match yours. And it's a rejection of any kind, no matter what community you're in, just sucks because we want to belong, we want to be understood, seen and heard. And naturally as humans, we want to be a part of something and belong to a group, whatever group that is. Even if we belong to the loners group, if we don't want to belong to a group, there is still an innate need deep down in our psychology. This is part of our evolutionary DNA, because in order to survive previously, we had to have people. And in some senses, we still do, but we need that. And so we don't want to be rejected by anyone, especially potential love interests, potential sexual interests, etc. And so I think it's okay to be afraid of that, but I don't want that fear to stop us from potentially putting ourselves in a place where we can gain something, where we are vulnerable, where we are sharing and communicating, because there's so much more to be gained than there is to be lost by having those discussions, by being open about our sexuality and our needs and our boundaries around our sexuality. There's so much more there than that potential rejection. And that fear limits people, especially people who contract an STI. It scares people from moving forward with their lives and enjoying all that there is to offer. And it breaks my heart because really, everyone has fear, everyone has shame, and we're always constantly, and a lot of it subconsciously, because we do these things automatically every day, like getting in our car to go to work, but we're constantly making these risk assessments. So if we can look at it from a little bit more of a logical place, a little bit more of an analytical, this is part of our practical nature of living and engaging and interacting, and accept and acknowledge the emotional response. Like, yes, it's okay to hate rejection, not want rejection, to feel awful when it happens, but one person's no is a yes someplace else. Every no we receive is a yes someplace else. You can't have yeses from everything all the time. You wouldn't be able to accomplish or achieve that or even do all those things. So you have to have some no's. Every time you say no to something, you're saying yes to something else. So there's just a way in which we can frame it, I think, that feels better and is more empowering for everyone making these decisions with their bodies.
I would absolutely agree with that. And rejection, like you said, it's part of life, but it doesn't have to be detrimental. So,
right. It teaches us something, right? There's something to be learned. And I don't love that kind of like woo-woo, or there's always a purpose or a reason for everything, and this is an opportunity, and sometimes things just suck, and it just sucks, and it feels awful, and that's okay. It's okay to be, this sucks, and that's not how I wanted this to turn out, and that was not the response I was hoping to get from having this conversation. But like when we're talking about disclosure, I hear a lot of times people talk about successful disclosure, and what they mean by that usually is the person said yes to them. So they disclosed their status, they talked about, and this could work for anything, all sexual needs, wants, boundaries, etc. They explained their kink, they explained their fetish, and the person said yes. So this was a successful communication of what they hoped to engage in. But really, I feel like successful, again, that also should be unpacked and reframed of, do I feel really good about, was I authentic in what I needed in my communication, what works for me, was I true to myself, do I feel pretty decent about how I approached this and that I honored where I wanted to head and what I needed in this scenario, regardless of their outcome. So that at least, even if it sucks and you're like, that's not what I was hoping that they would say, you can at least know that you did right by yourself, you even did right by your potential partners, and you can go forward with that as like, okay, I did a good job, I'm just going to do it again with somebody else or someone else's, and that's all right.
I think my favorite phrase for therapy is just embrace the suck.
Yes.
I say that to so many clients. Yes. Just embrace the suck. It's gonna pass, but you know what? We'll get there.
Yes, we're so culturally averse to bad, quote unquote, bad feelings, which aren't bad in and of themselves. They're not inherently bad. They feel bad at the time, but they're there for a reason. They're telling us something. We can identify where they're located, where it originated, what we want to glean from it, how we want to move forward. There's so much there. And sometimes it's okay. Just wallow for a little bit. Like, go for it. Sit on that couch and Netflix. Go for it. Like, it's okay. You know, we don't have to, we can't always possibly do everything great and feel happy about it. That's just, that doesn't even make any sense, really. Mm. You know, that outcome is not achievable. And I don't ever want that for anyone. I just want people to feel good eventually about where they're headed and where they've been.
I agree. I definitely have learned a lot in our conversation and just appreciate you taking the time to talk with us and educate our listeners.
It was absolutely my pleasure. Anytime.
Alrighty. Well, we are going to get off here and have a good evening, I guess.
That was a terrible
ending. That was terrible. I hate endings.
I usually do the endings, and I stared at her. I'm trying to teach her how to do endings, and she refuses.
I'm terrible at them. I could talk forever.
I can't.
Yes, I can empathize because I always do. I think it's called an Irish goodbye whenever my husband and I are at places. We've been teased for it because I'm like, okay, no one's looking, honey. Let's just leave. Let's go grab our stuff. We'll grab the dish that we brought to pass. Whatever drinks we have left over, if we're not leaving them there, and let's just quick get in our car and I'll send them a text message later and tell them how much fun we had. Like, I don't want to go hug everybody. I don't want to do this whole, like, okay, bye-bye.
Yes, it's so awkward to me.
I feel it. I'm an introvert. I think it's an introverted thing. I don't know if you're introverted or not, Stephanie, but for me, I think it's definitely an introvert thing.
Stephanie is introverted.
Like to me.
Your alternate ego is definitely not.
I am not introverted. I am very extroverted.
No. The true Stephanie is introverted.
The true Stephanie. I would. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You forget. I'm with you all the time.
You are. I do like a good Netflix session on the couch where I don't have to talk to anybody.
Yeah, but her Scarlet is the complete opposite. So, yeah.
My Scarlet is too. Oh, yeah. Give me a cocktail and put me in a party, and I don't leave until the cows come home. But if I decide I'm leaving, then I'm escaping, and nobody will know where I left until an hour or two later, and I'm already long gone and in bed.
Exactly. I think, yeah, that's you just described me in a nutshell. I love it.
Well, I will end for you.
Thank
because,
you.
Because we do have kiddos waiting at home, and we have a certain cutoff time ourselves.
Uh-huh.
No, we really do appreciate everything you brought to the table today. a lot of good information. We've been taking notes, definitely, so we definitely appreciate it, and we hope that we can have you again down the road, because there's going to come a time where we're going to do this show again, obviously not the same, but probably from a different aspect, and we would love to talk to you, especially with your background and expertise,
yeah,
if I can speak
absolutely.
Correctly on everything.
Oh, I'd love to. There's so much that it's hard to cover even in just an hour, and right. I'm so sorry I made y'all wait. I really didn't know, and then I looked at it. I'm like, why are they sending me like a link? And did I get the link? Like, and I figured I thought, I think I screwed that up. And then I looked back and I was like, wait a minute, no, it said 6:30.
Nope.
I had it written down on my calendar ever since our first conversation. And so then the email or the, yeah. Anyways, that next time I will look, that's a little mini lesson and like, don't quick bypass it and say, yeah, I'm coming.
No worries.
Anyway, so it was good. But I'm really sorry I made you wait, especially with kids and things. I enjoyed the conversation though and the opportunity to speak to your communities and so yes, thank you so much for inviting me and having me on. I appreciate it.
For sure. Well, we appreciate it.
Thank you. We'll talk soon.
Okay, sounds good. Good night, guys.
Good night. Bye.
Hey, Fox.
Not again.
Why don't you tell them where they can find us?
Oh, so you can find us on the Bookface.
Facebook.
Yeah, that thing. At the Kinky Coach. Or you can find us at any of the adult beverage websites. You like that?
I do, yeah.
Yes, because you're tasty, you're thirsty. Yeah.
Yes, thirsty.
So you can look for either Luna_and_Logan, or you can look for the Kiki Coach and her
Silver Fox.
Yeah.
So thank you for listening, and we hope you have a very sexy evening.
Have a good night.
You are listening to the Kinky Coach Podcast with Stephanie
and Fox.